Hi, this is James Devine, and I am an educator who has come out of the trenches. Listen in as my friend and colleague Dana Goodyear shares stories and tips from other educators who have come out of the trenches.
Welcome to the Out of the Trenches podcast. This is Dana Goodyear. Thanks for listening.
My next guest is Debbie Godfrey. Debbie has helped parents around the world for 30 years. She helps parents go from despair to hope with practical hands-on ideas. Parents that take Debbie's workshops leave ready to try new ideas with their children. Debbie is a certified parent educator and has worked with parents through her business, Positive Parenting, in schools and community centers around the world. Debbie is recognized for her humor and compassion while teaching behavior and discipline tools that work at home and in the classroom. Welcome to the podcast, Debbie.
Thank you so much for having me, Dana. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have somebody on who can speak to the parent lens for the educators that are listening, whether they are parents themselves or not, and also just kind of how, as educators, we can work better and partner with our parents. But I'll start out with the question I start out with everybody. Tell me about a time when you were in the trenches and managed to crawl out.
Yeah, and I was thinking about this, and I think for me, it had more to do with working with parents that were in the system. Mm-hmm. And so because I do parenting classes, I do mostly private or through schools and, you know, just general population. But at one point in time, I went and did some classes for Children's Protective Services. Mm-hmm. And so these were parents that had hurt their children and, you know, were picked up by the system. And I, after a few months of doing that work, that's exactly what I was calling it. It's like, wow, this is in the trenches. It was super challenging. And a good day for me was if, a parent sitting there with their arms crossed, just released their arms and appeared to be listening, you know, cause it's just, it's tough work when you're trying to help people that don't necessarily think or need or want to be helped.
And did that kind of transition to you getting started with Positive Parenting? In the pre-chat, you let me know that Positive Parenting has been in existence for 28 years. So how did you transition from this work with the parents in the system?
Yeah, and that is, it is how it happened. And I was doing volunteer work for an organization called Child Abuse and Neglect. And I was doing various tasks and different things for them. And at one point they said, how would you like to teach parenting classes and we'll pay you? And I was like, okay, sure. Yeah. And they, you know, and they had curriculum that was designed to bring parents up to a bare minimal standard and help them. And so it wasn't a hard curriculum but it was a hard population to work with. And so once I was able to get out and work with regular parents, I think it was a huge relief. Like, oh, okay, these people want to be here. They want to learn. And it wasn't that I didn't feel like I made a difference. I feel like I really did make a difference in the trenches. I tend to be pretty optimistic and pretty hopeful. And so I would just show up and teach no matter if, you know, people were listening or if I thought they were, what they were getting out of it. And I was even able to get some of them to get up and do the exercises with me and play along with some of the role plays and things that I do in the class to teach parents.
And you've been giving these classes for quite a while, but you said even before you started doing the virtual classes during the pandemic, you were doing classes over the phone. So was that like a multi-way conversation or was it more one-on-one coaching over the phone?
No, I was doing group. I called them teleclasses because they were over the phone. So I try to keep my classes less than 24 people because it just gets a little, unless it's a workshop or something like that, it gets a little overwhelming. So I'd have somewhere between 15 and 25 people on the phone. And there was, before all the Zoom really came into being, which Zoom was around before the pandemic, but just not to the extent it is now. But there was several audio conferencing, including like free conference call. And the one I used was Maestro Conference. And so it was a version of where you would get on and be able to facilitate a group interaction, and very similar to Zoom, but it was more simple, and everybody was on the phone. And so there was ways to mute and unmute people. I could bring everybody on. I could I break them up into rooms? I don't remember that, but I was actually facilitating my entire classes that way. Mm-hmm. And the positives to it was I was able to reach parents all over the world that I wasn't mm-hmm. able to reach other than through traveling. So anybody anywhere in the world could take a class with me. The downside is I really like being in the room with parents. Mm-hmm. There's nothing like, I do a lot of experiential exercises and I still do those over the phone, over Zoom. It's just that it's harder for me. I think it's harder work for me to facilitate the exercises. There's a lot of things that I do physically. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're working with children, and I think teachers especially, like you're in a classroom, some child's acting up, you know, to just kind of walk over and stand behind them, maybe put your hand on their shoulder, and that'll kind of calm them down or remind them that they should be listening. And, you know, something like that is difficult to do over the phone, right? Because you're not saying anything. Mm-hmm. I'm just walking over. And so I have to, when I'm teaching a class on the phone, I have to say, okay, I'm walking over towards the child now. I'm putting my hand out on their back. I'm rubbing their back. I'm smiling. You know, I have to describe every body language and gesture that I'm making. And Zoom increased that a little bit because now we can see each other, but I still can't do the physical. You know, sometimes I just want to reach through this screen and be able to hug a parent, you know, especially because, you know, sometimes it can be very emotional teaching mm-hmm. over Zoom, especially when we're in some deep conversations. And there's times where I just want to hug a parent and I can't do it through the Zoom. Mm-hmm. But we do it in the chat, and you know, people really support each other well. So that's the other advantage to this. I think people have really grown used to interacting, and we've found ways to connect with each other deeply, even though we're not in person anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you do hit that wider audience. So you live in Kentucky, and you're giving these classes then to people throughout the U.S., North America, and around the world still through the Zoom.
Absolutely. And when I was doing when the pandemic hit, my best friend called me up. She's like, you have to do something. I'm like, well, I don't want to do anything. She's like, you have to help parents. They're, you know, the kids are home and they're home working, and you have, and I'm like, okay, I'll only do it if you do it with me. And so she mm-hmm. was my wingman. She came on and she made all the Zoom happen. She kept everybody engaged in the chat, and I got to just show up and teach. And we taught every day for about 8 months when the pandemic hit, not on weekends, but Monday mm-hmm. through Friday, I'd just pick a different topic. It was half an hour, so parents could just jump on. We'd do a half an hour topic, and it was fabulous. And we had parents from 24 different countries. Wow. We added them up at one point. And every day, I mean, we had a mom from India. It was midnight in India, and she would be on with us every day because it was 2 p.m. Eastern time. And she was on. She'd sit outside so she didn't wake up her family, and she'd sit there with her little camera or whatever she was zooming on. And it was just fabulous. And just, yeah, every country you can imagine. And mm-hmm. It was really fabulous. It was wonderful work to do during that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely imagine parents needed that support and to hear some advice. And we'll go ahead and get into some of your strategies and some questions. And, you know, the listeners can kind of think of this from a educator lens also. But how does encouragement play into teaching and role playing when you're working with kids and, you know, encouraging them to do work if they're especially not interested in the task?
Right. Yeah. And I think one of the things that we don't often realize is that mm-hmm. how to say good for you is really important. And so there's a way to say good for you that's very generic. Mm-hmm. And this is what most of us call praising, you know, a good boy, good girl, mm-hmm. I'm proud of you. Very, very generic languaging. And that tends to be limited in its ability to encourage a child. So instead, to use what we call encouragement, which is more specific and detailed. So I love the way you stayed in the lines when you colored here, or mm-hmm. It's so interesting that you came up with that solution to that problem and name whatever thing that they solved, or what a great observation you just made about, you know, whatever that they're working on. And so really thinking in terms of specifics, and the example I like to give is something even like, I love you. Like you don't ever want to stop saying, I love you to your children. I guess you're not saying that to students, but to, you know, just to say, I really appreciate you, you know, I love what you're doing. And so then you take it to that next step, instead of just saying, I love you, or I appreciate you, what I love about you is, and then you fill in the blank with something super specific, or what I appreciate about you is the way you, your smile lights up the class and makes everybody's day, you know, so much better, or I love the way you were being so helpful and helping your neighbor, or whatever it is. To get as specific as you can is the way to light children and all of us up. We all love definitely. To hear how we're doing well. It's nice to, you know, for somebody to say great or good, or, you know, I'm proud of you, but it's different when you say, oh, wow, you really worked really hard. You should be proud of yourself. Like that's a whole different encouragement than when a parent or teacher says, I'm proud of you, it actually takes a little bit of weight. Like, for example, Dana, if let's say you work for me and you've worked on this project for a month and you finally finish it and you bring it to me and you hand it to me and I look at it and I'm like, oh, Dana, I am so proud of you. Like, how does that feel?
It feels validated.
It does, but it's also a little weird, right? Like, I'm proud of you. Like, did I do anything to make that project happen?
No, it feels like you're asking for that validation when you did all the work. And yeah, I think it's not as much encouragement as, like, I think more along the way would have helped, because you would have been working on that for a month.
Right. And you were, and I didn't do anything because I'm just the boss. And now I'm going to take all the credit for your work and I'm proud of you. And so, and this, I think, kids, I think kind of sense that little uncomfort, like, well, you're proud of me, but what did you do? I did this. And so when we just flip the wording a little bit and say, oh, wow, I can see you're really proud of how much effort you put in to pull your grade up from a C to a B. That must have been really hard, because math's a challenging topic for you. And that's just a different way for a child to receive the acknowledgement of how hard they worked.
Yeah. And I think, you know, even when I was starting out as a teacher, you know, I had those words of encouragement near my desk. And, you know, I always try to make it a point to use more than just the good job, right? Or the great, you know, just different ways of saying those things and encouraging kids. But I think as educators and parents, we don't do that enough, right? But yeah, to really have that validation that kids are doing a good job, and that we see them. I think that's really the point that you were making with, you know, the encouragement piece. And how about if there is a parent who is working with school staff and they have a defiant child, and the child might be really defiant at home, but not so defiant at school, or vice versa. And, you know, there's a parent and teacher meeting, or it might be a meeting with the administration and the whole teacher team. So how can educators support the child and the parent in this situation?
Right. And so, you know, most of the time I'm on the side of talking to parents and encouraging parents to make teachers part of their team, and to understand, like, it doesn't help to go and shoot your teacher's foot, like that. They're trying to help your child. So you don't want to go in there raging at your teacher. It's like, you want to approach your teacher with, what can I do? How can I help? And one thing that I don't believe in is double discipline. And so what happens often is children will be disciplined in the classroom for some behavior, and then they'll go home and you know, whether the teacher called or a note goes home or whatever, and then they'll get punished at home again for the same thing. I don't think that's fair. So what I encourage parents to do is to ask the teacher, like, this is, you know, to have a conversation. I see that my child's misbehaving in this way. Let me understand how you're correcting it in the classroom, and let me come up with ways that I can mirror that at home. So when my child does a similar behavior, I'll respond that way. So that's one way I encourage parents to be on the team with the teachers. And I think teachers, you know, it's important. I know what I hear mostly is most of you know already the children that are in circumstances where they have parental support and the circumstances where they don't. And I think when those parents aren't on board, you kind of are stuck. And that's a difficult situation, because without somebody encouraging that parent to communicate with you more effectively or at all, or in the child's behalf, it's really a tough situation. But from my perspective, the double discipline is the thing I always worry about. And so as a teacher, if you have created some kind of discipline for this child with the behavior that they're doing in your classroom, when you send that note home or you make that call, I think if you tell the parent, I've already disciplined your son or daughter by doing this, they did this behavior. And so I, you know, had them write extra things or did whatever your discipline was in the classroom. I don't want you to punish them again at home for doing this, but maybe you could come up with ways if your child, and, you know, name the misbehavior. If your child does something similar like this at home, maybe you can create a self-quieting area, like the way that I had them go to a self-quieting area in the classroom. And so that you could help the parent with the discipline. And I know it's not a teacher's job to teach parents how to parent. Like, you don't have enough on your plate already. But because you're asking, you know, from my standpoint as the parenting teacher, a lot of parents, I think, could benefit from that guidance. And if they're open to it and receptive to it, it could be super helpful for their student and in turn for you. Because if that child starts getting consistent discipline at home, that's following what you're doing in the classroom, the behavior in the classroom should get better and improve, you know, with that support.
Yeah. What about
this podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. Explore more podcasts at www.teachbetterpodcastnetwork.com. Now let's get back to the episode.
When a child won't listen, you talked a little bit in the pre-chat about the systematic approach to discipline. So this could be like a parent at home, the child doesn't want to, that's my problem as a parent. My kids don't always want to do the dishes, right? You can ask them a million times. But you know, the teachers and parents have that issue of a child won't listen. They don't want to do a specific task. So how do you approach those situations?
Yes. So the systematic approach is an Adlerian approach. And probably many educators have had some classes in something similar, the Adlerian psychology or Rudolf Dreiker's. It's the idea of a mistaken goal system or mistaken goal chart. So that whenever children are misbehaving, they're misbehaving because they're discouraged from getting their needs met, to feel loved, to feel valuable, to feel powerful, to feel like they have a place to experiment and explore. And so in the classroom, when you're dealing with misbehavior or at home, you want to ask yourself, when your child's misbehaving, you want to take a deep breath and ask yourself, oh, my child's misbehaving. They must be discouraged. Discouraged from what? From getting one of those needs met. You don't even have to name the need in order for this system to work. Okay. So you just go on the assumption, my child's discouraged, and that's why they're misbehaving, because they're getting that need met, say to feel powerful, through this defiant behavior or their disobedience in some way. And so further, this Adlerian psychology and the systematic approach says that when a child is in a misbehavior, we, the parent, we, the teacher, can diagnose their misbehavior by the way we're feeling, as opposed to what they're doing. And so there's four mistaken goals. They're attention, power, revenge, and inadequacy. And then teachers, you have a fifth goal. It's the goal of significance in the classroom. Parents don't get that one. it's something unique to the classroom. And so when you're interfacing with a child and the child misbehaves, you take a deep breath and you ask yourself, how am I feeling? And there's certain feelings that come up in us that are associated with each of those four goals. So when you when the child's misbehaving in a way, like let's say they're tapping their pencil on the desk and being super annoying, you can take a deep breath and go, oh, I'm feeling annoyed right now. Like that's annoying behavior. And that would lead you to diagnose the goal of attention. Mm-hmm. So annoyance and frustration go with the goal of attention. Now, if that kid's sitting there tapping their pencil and looking at you with defiance, you would, in that moment, you would be feeling challenged or provoked. Yeah. In that situation, you go, oh, I'm feeling challenged. He's challenging me right now. And so then that would lead you to diagnose the goal of power. Mm-hmm. And then further, the child's tapping that and just looking at you like with glaring and anger and just disgust, then you might be feeling hurt. Like, what did I do to deserve this? Mm-hmm. That would lead to the goal of revenge. And then if the child's tapping and they're not even tapping and they're like giving up and they're whining, that would tend to lead us to feel helpless, hopeless, despair. How can I help you? Pity, how pathetic this behavior is. And that's the goal of inadequacy. The goal of significance is a little more like they're trying to take over your job. Mm-hmm. The ones that want to be the teacher. So, yeah. You know, you'll be feeling like upstaged.
Yeah, and there are kids that do that in the classroom.
Totally. Yes. And it's a unique to the classroom goal that we don't cover for the parents. Mm-hmm. And so if you can figure out which of those misbehaviors this child or this student is doing, then there's a whole set of corrective measures that goes mm-hmm. with each of those. So for the child, it's in the goal of attention. So they're just being annoying and frustrating. They're just seeking attention. And we all say this, oh, they're just looking for attention, but that doesn't correct the misbehavior that's going on, mm-hmm. right? Saying that just doesn't correct it. So the redirection for that one is to approach the child without looking at them and without talking to them. So if you're mm-hmm. teaching in front of the classroom, this is the one where you actually walk over to this child, maybe behind them, and you mm-hmm. you rub their back. So you touch them and you rub their back, but you don't let them take your attention with eye contact or with words, because then that reinforces their mistaken belief that says, hey, if I keep you busy with me, then I'm loved.
Yeah.
And so I've got to interrupt you. So instead their new belief is, oh, I can feel loved. Like you come over and you rub my back or you hold my hand and I don't have to interrupt you. So it's changing their mistaken belief. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. For the goal of power, this one I have a whole 2-hour workshop on, so I'll just give you a couple of tips on this one. It's not a simple solution like some of the others are, but basically you want to think in terms of, how can I give this child more power? Mm-hmm. How can I help them figure out a way to be more powerful right now? So, you know, giving them choices, offering them ideas of different things that they can do to contribute. I also have a tool that's more silent. So if you're in a power struggle over something with a child and that tends to escalate into a verbal battle, instead of doing that, to just be silent and approach the child calmly mm-hmm. and with a friendly smile on your face, put your hand on their back, rub their back, smile at them. Mm-hmm. And then you want to give a nonverbal signal for what you want. So the exercise I usually do is like a trash can thing. So I'll look at the trash can, look at my watch. And when you're smiling and rubbing their back, it just takes all the fight out of them. Mm-hmm. And they just can't keep the power struggle going with you. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how that works.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can imagine some teachers, you know, implementing this in their classroom, and you know, it's something that the kid I think wouldn't expect necessarily, especially if they've kind of been in that power struggle situation with the teacher for a couple months already into the school year. But yeah, it would be interesting to see how the dynamic would change.
Yeah, it's interesting because I teach redirecting for a cooperative classroom. So it's very mm-hmm. similar to the parenting class, but it's four teachers in the classroom setting. And the one challenge or issue that I have and that teachers have is that this type of discipline mm-hmm. takes one-on-one.
Yeah.
And when you've got a classroom of 24 or 30 or 35 students, it's incredibly challenging to have mm-hmm. a one-on-one time, to be able to take that one-on-one time to do some of this type of redirecting. And so it's an interesting dynamic to figure that out as a teacher. Like, I know if I give my time and attention to this child, I can redirect it efficiently and effectively, but I'm taking away time from all these other kids. Mm-hmm. Like, how is that fair? Yeah. Like, how does that work? And so you're constantly faced with this dilemma of, do I take that time away and correct this, or do I just keep trying to fumble along with what I've got going? And that's another reason I know most teachers do this, but we also teach the classroom meetings, because oftentimes you can set up things in the classroom meeting format so that kids will handle some of these things on their own and the teacher doesn't have to. That's the beauty of effective classroom meetings, where you set up the classroom rules, say, at the beginning of the year, and then anything that's out of that gets redirected to the meeting agreements, and the kids can help with all of that so that it's not all in the teacher's hands.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, because that's something you can always refer back to during the year. And, you know, this, like, that classroom code of conduct, they agree, you know, to adhere by, you know, these expectations. And, you know, there is the odd kid that will come and, you know, challenge you, but yeah, and kind of have those leadership roles also in the classroom. Yeah, I think that's something is definitely a good tip to follow. What about a child that whines either at home or in the classroom and says that I can't? What are some tips that you tend to cover in your courses with this?
Yeah, so that's the goal of inadequacy. So that's the one where they're saying, I can't, I'm so tired, and you're going to be feeling helpless, hopeless, pity. Or I tell parents, because a lot of parents, and probably teachers too, don't feel sorry for this child anymore, because they're always doing this behavior, and they know it's kind of a game, or they're playing them or whatever. And so you have to still feel sorry for them in order to identify this goal correctly, because if you don't, then you won't be able to assess it as the goal of inadequacy and then and then correct it. So make sure if they're behaving in that way, maybe you're not feeling sorry for them, but maybe you look at that behavior and you go, how pathetic.
Yeah.
And to me, that's always a good clue that it's this goal. So if they're in this goal, one of the things, there's actually two ideas. And the first one is an idea that I call distract them and give it to them. Okay. So when my kids used to come home from school, they would come home and they would throw their backpacks down on the floor in the living room. And if I said, go pick up your backpacks, they go, oh, I'm so tired. We just got to school all day. Blah, blah, blah. And so they're whining. And so I would walk over to them. This is the distracting part. And I would be like, wow, you must have had a really rough day. I can see you're super tired. And I would lean over and I would pick up the backpack and I would hand it to them. And the child would just take it. And then I'd have my arm around him and I'd walk with them down to their bedroom as I'm talking about what a hard day they've had. And so that's the distract them, give it to them. We get to their bedroom. They toss their backpack into their bedroom and issue over. Mm-hmm. Now, if the child was in the goal of power, mm-hmm. What would happen when I handed them the backpack? What do you think?
They'd probably want to have a power struggle with you.
They would throw it down or throw it at you. Yes.
Or just leave it. Say, why are you picking that up? It's my backpack.
Right. Like, so it has to only be this goal. Mm-hmm. The correction for each goal doesn't fit on the other goals. It only works with the goal that it goes with. So that's one idea, is this idea of distract them and give it to them in whatever the situation is. The other one is to break up whatever is overwhelming this child into smaller steps, and then celebrate successes in between. So this is one with my daughter. She used to come home when she was about four. She'd get home and she would get to the bottom of the stairs and she'd start whining, I can't get up the stairs, I'm so tired. And I'd be like, Michelle, just fight with your brother in the car, get up the stairs. And I can't. And we had this thing, and I finally get so frustrated, I'd go over and pick her up and I'd carry her up the stairs, which of course reinforced this misbehavior. And so it was going on for a couple of weeks. Like, every day we'd get home and she'd get at the bottom of the stairs and do this miserable thing until I picked her up and carried her. And so finally I get out my book and I'm looking at, what am I, okay, because I knew I was doing something wrong. And I'm reading and I realize, okay, this is the goal of inadequacy. And I came to this tool, break it into smaller steps and celebrate successes. So the day comes, I'm ready now. She gets to the bottom of the stairs and she's like, I can't get up the stairs, I'm so tired. And so I got down next to her and I said, Michelle, do you think you could make it up three steps? I don't know, give it a try. And I went up with her and I'm like, yay, you did three steps. And then how about three more? yay, good job, all the way up the stairs like that. The next day we get home from school, she didn't do it. So what the redirecting did there was take the wind out of her sails. So it took away the goodies she was getting by dominating the incident when she was whining and I was carrying her up. And so that all, it all stopped. And this is true. I teach this for parents with homework and for teachers in school. If you have a child who's doing this, I can't, and whining thing, you really look more deeply at if they're feeling capable, because most of the time they're feeling like they can't. So rather than seeing it so much as a misbehavior, it's more of that they need extra support, extra help. So make sure they might need tutoring. I mean, maybe this is, you know, if they're really struggling in a subject and you've done your best to work with them, maybe suggesting to the parent that they get a tutor. And it's amazing how helpful a good tutor can be with just an hour a week of assisting in a course that a child's struggling with.
Yeah. And I think a lot of the time it's actually kind of diagnosing those behaviors and the fact that it may not be behavior. It might just be that academic struggle and the child isn't able to voice it.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's important across the board, is assessing whether is this just normal child, because there's a lot of things that are in the back of the book that I teach out of, they have common, normal, annoying behaviors by age and stage. So like, you know, whatever it is, 3 or 5 year olds picking their nose, I guess it's 5 or 6 year olds picking their nose is normal. It's annoying, but it's normal. Like there's not anything, you know, and it doesn't mean you don't redirect it, but you redirect it from the standpoint of this is normal. It's a phase. This too will pass. And to not really get entrenched with, I've got to teach the child something. No, this is just something that they'll move through this. Yeah. They'll figure out eventually when their friends start saying stuff to them, not to pick their nose so much and or not. Right. Yeah. So there's a lot of those and you want to assess it. And I think another thing is having age appropriate expectations is super important. And teachers, you can be really aware of this. You probably already can know how to assess this much better than parents do. And so if you hear a parent that's having too high or too low of expectations, to coach that parent into understanding what a child can and is able to be doing at this age and stage, and not, not having, because having too high of expectations is super discouraging and having too low of expectations is as well. And discouraged kids misbehave. So anytime the child gets discouraged by any form or fashion, they're going to misbehave. And then we have to go into that chart and figure out how to correct their misbehavior.
Yeah, that's a good point. Sometimes teachers are working with parents that are divorced. And, you know, you'll talk to each parent about maybe a behavior situation or assignments that haven't been turned in. And, you know, sometimes you call the dad, sometimes you call the mom. But what can a teacher do if there's like conflicting viewpoints from the parents? And they might not even be divorced, but it's like, you know, you get all these different viewpoints. And so the parents basically don't agree on how to handle the situation with their child. How can an educator kind of work through the situation then?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to remember that kids are super resilient.
Yeah.
And kids also learn that. I like the idea of mom's house, dad's house. It's actually the name of a book and I've taught out of it. And it's this idea that this is how it is at mom's house. Yeah. This is how it is at dad's house. Yeah. So if you've got parents that are separated, just know you're probably going to have two different conversations.
Yeah.
And that the children will learn how to adapt in each environment. The problem happens when the parents are trying to change the other one. Mm-hmm. And there's not really much you can do about that. Mm-hmm. But that's where I come in when I'm coaching parents. It's like, okay, like you do your best parenting at home. You cannot parent what's going on over at the other parent's house. Yeah. And it's not so true when you're in the home together, then it's more of a marital issue. And I have referred not just a few parents to marriage counseling before parenting classes, because to me, that relationship sets the tone for the entire family. And so if you've got two parents in high conflict and working against each other, there's not a lot of room for effective parenting there.
Yeah.
That kind of division is a field day for misbehavior in kids. And so, you know, gently suggesting to the parents suggesting how important their relationship is, that they're role modeling leadership, that that they agreeing is more important than either one being right. Mm-hmm. That all of those things are, you know, super gentle prods that you can give to those parents. And at a certain point, you know, there isn't anything you can do. If these people really need marriage counseling, that's going to be up to them to decide to do. You can't make that happen. And you know, and just know that that child is super conflicted, and your love and support probably is going to be the thing that gets them through their life. Honestly, mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. Teachers, one thing I love about teachers is like, you are the grandmas, you know, yeah. Like you're the special angels in children's lives that help some of them survive. Like mm-hmm. some kids absolutely wouldn't survive without you. And so you never know every day which child you're going to touch and how you're going to touch them. That's just going to stay with them for their whole lives. And so, you know, it's just important that you keep your courage up, you keep yourself encouraged, and you know, and just do your best in the situations where you know those kids are going home to a super charged home environment.
Yeah, good point. Well, I've learned so much about just effective parenting tools and, you know, how to work with children that have misbehaviors in the classroom and through those lens that, you know, are both common for at home and in school behaviors. Out of everything we talked about today on the podcast, what's one thing you'd like listeners to remember?
Well, I think the thing is connection. And yeah. And even again, I know there's 30 kids in a classroom, but to have that one-on-one connection, there's nothing mm-hmm. that replaces that. And so, you know, however you make mention of it, I know one of my favorite things to watch on LinkedIn or whatever are the mm-hmm. videos posted where the teachers do the like, different handshakes and the different high fives as the students are going in the classroom. Like to me, that's that one-on-one connection that you make. And it only takes 5 minutes when the kids are entering the classroom. Like each one gets a special, you know, they get to choose their hug, their high five, their whatever it is. Do you know which one I'm talking about, Dana? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's super sweet. And so if you can figure out a way to systemize the getting a connection in with each child each day, somehow making it a point that each child gets something from you, you know, a smile, an eye contact, a word, that's all mm-hmm. it takes. And I think that's going to take you farther than anything else, is making that one-on-one deep connection on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, great words to remember. Where can people connect with you and find you online and find out more about your courses?
positiveparenting.com. That's my website. Very easy to remember, positiveparenting.com. Also on Instagram at positiveparentingdebbie. Mm-hmm. And I have a podcast that's Positive Parenting Pep Talks. It's a 3 to 5 minute pep talk every day. I just pick a different topic every day and do it in 3 to 5 minutes. So, because parents can't sit and listen to these half an hour podcasts all the time. So I'm doing the quick bursts. And over time, every day, you'll get a lot of good positive parenting tips.
Great. I'll make sure to include that in the show notes. Thank well, you. It's been a pleasure having you on the Out of the Trenches podcast today. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much, Dana. And thank you for having me.
Check out the show notes on danagoodyear.com to learn more about this guest and links to their social media. Please subscribe, share, rate, and review wherever you download this podcast. Tell your friends and colleagues about it, and if this episode resonates especially with you, be sure to share it out on social media and tag me at Out of Trenches PC.